There's a song written by a guy who had a lot of mental and personal challenges. His name was Peter Green, and this might be his masterpiece. It's Oh Well, Fleetwood Mac from 1969. Kind of how we all feel about technology and the rise of the surveillance state. Oh well. Well, we've saved some of the weirdest stuff for last in our interview with Robert Guffey about his new book, Camelio. Some very strange paths still to come here in our final hour of Coast to Coast. Don't go away. Robert, I'm sure you've asked yourself why you are allowed to move forward with the book. They could certainly stop you if they, I'm using air quotes around it, wanted to. I suppose, I was only half joking about at the beginning of the program when I said if they're ever going to sabotage a broadcast, this would be it. But I suppose that maybe at this point they want it to leak out there in some regard. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. Selling this book was the most difficult thing I've ever done. I mean, when I the first time thing I did was when we interviewed Richard, I condensed the interview down to publishable level. I got it down to like 5,000 words, and I sent it to several magazines I thought would be interested, Wired, things like that. And usually, no matter where you submit an article to, you will always get a response. Either it's either no thank you, a form letter, or maybe something larger than that, but you always get a response. For some reason, with that particular piece, I got no responses from nobody. It's as if they had never seen it. It was eventually published in UFO Magazine, and the reason I wanted it published in UFO Magazine is because I thought that the people who read the magazine might read the interview with Richard and then begin rethinking some of their own experiences. And then when I say that, I want to be careful and note that even though you definitely could use Richard Schoengert's Project Camelio technology to fake an alien abduction, that doesn't mean that I think that all
Right.
alien abductions are explained in that way. I tend to think that they're mimicking a real phenomenon, because, as you pointed out in your book, that doesn't explain events that happened in the 1800s that were documented by Charles Fort in his books, right?
Well, a name that comes up in your book is Melinda Leslie. It's somebody known to this program. I think she's been on the program. I know her. She's the most best known advocate of the idea that there are human abductions. There are abductions involving the military that are staged to look like alien events. Talk about that a little bit.
It's interesting. I was at a restaurant in Costa Mesa with Melinda, and I started telling her this whole story. And I got up to the point of talking about Richard, and the point where I said that Richard had met with a corporation from San Diego, and that this corporation was interested in his technology. And before I could say it, Melinda goes, "Was it SAIC?" And I said, "Yes. How did you know that?" And she said, "That name comes up, that corporation comes up over and over and over again in these My Lab scenarios. My Lab meaning military abduction. People who are abductees, they're abducted by aliens, and then later re-abducted by humans, usually military-looking people who interrogate them and are extremely interested in wanting to know how the technology runs. Were you able to? Were you? Did they allow you to steer the ship? How does the ship work? Describe it to us." And they're gearheads. They all want to know exactly how everything works, right? And often the My Lab, the people who experience the My Lab abductions, report that the re-abductions by the humans are far more traumatic and terrible than the abductions by the aliens. Which I don't know what that says, but it's disturbing. Yes, I spoke to, in fact, earlier this year, I interviewed Melinda for about 4 hours and a half, because I'm working on a book that's tentatively entitled Imaginauts, Exploring the Outer Reaches of the Mind, in which I want to profile various people who I think are sort of on the cutting edge of the new paradigm, and I would certainly consider Melinda to be one of those people, though I don't think she considers herself to be one of those people. She sort of lives in the new paradigm 24/7, so I think it's normal to her, but not to other people. The entire MyLab phenomenon, I think, does tie into the scenario in Camellio, and in fact ties back to a book that was published in the late 1970s, and that is Messengers of Deception by Jacques Vallée, who, by the way, the publicity manager at the Aura Books contacted me and said, "I got this letter in the mail from someone who wants me to give him your home address. Can I give it out to him?" And I said, "Well, who is it?" And he goes, "It's this guy. I don't know. It's a French guy, Jacques Vallée. I don't know." And I said, "Oh, Jacques Vallée? Yes, give him my address, please." And Jacques Vallée sent me a note, just a brief note, saying that he liked Camellio and liked it even better than Cryptosyntology, which was my first book. And so I've been meaning to write him back and say thank you, but it occurred to me he might be listening. So thank you, Jacques Vallée, for the note. But in that book, Messengers of Deception, Jacques Vallée mentions meeting this man who he calls Major Murphy, but it's not his real name, who first introduces to him the idea that alien abductions could be something that could be faked. And he mentions several military operations where they took advantage of the local folklore. For example, in Vietnam, the Vietnamese had deep beliefs about vampires, and they actually staged these murders to look like as if vampires had attacked these Vietnamese, hung them upside down from trees with holes in their necks, things like that. This was an actual military operation. There was a scenario back in the 50s where the CIA was spying on Tibet, and they used an imaginary expedition to hunt for the abominable snowman in order to do that.
You know,
So
you could say, thank goodness our military has these capabilities to use them and to protect us. And then you hear stories about people like Melinda Leslie who are terrorized, or your friend Damien, who they're spying on him in the bathroom in his most private moments. That's not what I want our government to be doing.
Oh, Damien said to me several times that he got the sense that there was a definite perverse aspect to all of this. And it seems to me that the people who are doing this are either compromised people, criminals themselves, people who have been arrested. They're made a deal. We can either send you to jail or you do this for us. So the people who are doing this are already compromised people.
And there's no oversight to speak of. I mean, it's
No.
completely out of the purview of Congress or, inspector generals or something like that.
Absolutely. And also, I wanted to mention before I forget that if there are people listening who are being gang stalked, and I'm sure there are people listening who are being gang stalked, I would like to recommend a website that's called fightgangstalking.com. There's a lot of websites out there about gang stalking, and a lot of them are either useless or disinformation or crazy. But this particular one is extremely useful and rational. Fightgangstalking.com, and there's a section called Tactics for Fighting Back, and it's just a long list of things that you can do that are very simple to fight back against this kind of harassment.
All right, we'll check it out. I want to go back to the interview with the engineer because there's so much that we have not covered. You mentioned how Melinda Leslie pops up with the name SAIC. This engineer did the same thing, sort of, and when talking about who might have ripped off his technology, that's what he came up with.
And of course he mentions it before Damien starts telling him the story. I mean, that was the first. That's where my eyebrows suddenly were raised when he, where Richard mentions the San Diego connection, and then it was just one link after another after that. During the course of that interview, Richard, who's a very interesting person, by the way. I mean, I recently interviewed him again at his home. I'm looking at the manuscript right now. I'm editing it as we speak, and I in this new interview, I focus entirely on just Richard's interest in Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, esoteric mysticism, and its connection to science. And so I he covers in there how the main inspiration for Project Camellia actually came from the fact that he's a Rosicrucian, and that he had known people, or he had heard of people in the Rosicrucian order who claimed that they could make themselves invisible, that they had such control of their mind that they could make it like the shadow. They could make it seem like hypnotize people so that others could not see them. And that this idea fascinated him, and he began thinking, well, how could you do that with science, you know, and not mysticism? Richard had a top secret clearance all the way up until he retired, which was just last year at age 85. During the course of this interview, he suddenly brings up names like Bob Lazar and Philip Corso, and I wasn't really expecting that.
No, I was really surprised. I mean, I had no idea that's where the book was heading, and was very surprised when first Corso and then the Lazar name came up. Corso, I don't remember seeing this in the book, but you might recall that Colonel Corso had said that he handled, of course you note this, but he had handled wreckage, you know, that his employer had wreckage from a crashed saucer, and that they'd dispersed it to labs that do work for the military, didn't really tell him where it came from, and let them sort of develop it. I don't know if you remember, but one of the things he says that came from the wreckage was night vision goggles.
Ah, yes. Yes, I had forgotten that. Yeah, you're right.
There's a certain symmetry there with your engineer saying that he was familiar with Corso, and he thought the scenario was perfectly plausible, that maybe that's exactly how it would work, that even some of the researchers who think they came up with some of the ideas don't realize where the initial inspiration came from.
Oh, yeah. Richard had no problem with that idea at all. In fact, when I asked him, when he brought up the film The Predator, And then I say, well, do you think it's possible that some of these films are actually leaked information, you know, a kind of time-released aspirin? He immediately leapt on that and said, oh, yeah, absolutely. He had no problem with that idea at all. And in fact, right after that interview with Richard was published in UFO Magazine, I got an amusing phone call from a woman who is actually a rather well-known special effects expert in Hollywood, and she was working on the film G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, which has invisibility technology in it, and she called me after having read this interview with Richard in UFO Magazine, and she wanted to know if Richard had any of these invisibility suits, like, on hand so that she could use them in the movie, and I had to explain to her, well, you know, this is a theoretical concept, like, he doesn't have these hanging in the closet, he's not like Tony Stark, and he has invisibility suits hanging in the closet, and so I nonetheless I put them in touch with each other. I said, well, he could act as, you know, an advisor on the film. So she called him and said, would you be interested in advising us on how this should look in the film? And then Richard said, oh, sure, are you, how much were you intending on paying me for this? And she said, oh, well, we weren't going to pay anything, but you could have, like, your credit at the end of the movie, you could see your name there.
Yeah.
Right. And so he declined.
Yeah, because G.I. Joe didn't have a budget. It was only, you know, $25,000, I'm sure.
As I mentioned in the book, like films like G.I. Joe, which show, you know, the great American hero using that invisibility technology in such an extraordinary way, it kind of becomes a recruitment video for future generations who will no doubt be sent into dangerous situations wearing invisibility suits, either to fight terrorists or to fight your local drug addict in Pacific Beach.
On the mention of Lazar, his take on it seemed to be that Lazar was sort of a victim of a disinformation plot, that he was used. I don't remember you mentioning this, but it occurred to me as I was reading it, is that Lazar had always told me he worked for the U.S. Navy, that it was the U.S. Navy that ran the program out there at S4, which is pretty interesting if you think about it, that the Navy would have a presence at that facility.
That is fascinating. If I knew that, I had forgotten it, and that reframes things in an interesting way. You know, there's another connection between the reason that Richard brings up Lazar is because, as we're talking to him about Damien's experiences, he suddenly says, "This reminds me of the way that Bob Lazar was harassed," and I don't think that Bob Lazar has ever reported anything similar to gang stalking, but he was harassed and surveilled.
Well, there was a lot of stuff. There was a whole lot of stuff. They followed him. Tapped his phones. They broke into his house. Would move things around. They would write things on his blackboard. Broke into his car and leave the glove box open and his gun laying there. All stuff just to mess with his head. There are some similarities. Yes.
There are similarities there, but and also an interesting similarity that occurs to me is that whenever I've heard Bob Lazar interviewed or seen interviews with him, one thing that I notice is that he always has a sort of dry sense of humor
That's
about
true.
the experiences. You
Oh,
know what
yeah.
I mean? And that's something that Damien also had, and I think that's one way. It seems mundane. It seems like a mundane observation, but I think it's actually extremely important is to maintain a sense of humor in the midst of all of this, because it's something that enables you to survive even the darkest situations. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book the way I wrote it. I didn't want to write a book that was like a guy standing on a bench in Venice Beach yelling through a megaphone about the coming apocalyptic fascist state that was coming to control everybody. I think that turns people off, and people don't want to be preached at. And so in my original proposal that I sent to John Oakes at Aura Books, I said I want to write this book in such a way that it's entertaining on one level. And I've been writing short stories, publishing short stories since I was 24. I teach literature classes and creative writing classes, so I really came at the book thinking of it as literature first and propaganda second, or literature first and journalism second, because I think that people tend to sort of block out anything that sounds like a sermon. And so the book has a definite sense of humor about it, but it also has a serious message underlying it.
Well, it is. It's a fun read, and the comparisons to Hunter Thompson are not entirely just out of the blue. I was thinking of Kinky Friedman too, and some of the style and some of the storytelling. You mentioned also in the interview with the engineer, you ask him a question about I don't remember if you ask it or he volunteers it, but the idea of, let's say you wanted to drive Fidel Castro or somebody like that crazy. Oh yeah, you could do that.
Yes, and well, not only does he say you could do that, he said I included the psychological warfare aspects in my original proposal. And I have to take a step back and mention the fact that when you meet Richard, he's like the nicest guy on the planet. I've never met a more affable human being, and he wouldn't be the first researcher or scientist who was naive enough to think that the military would use his invention for good. I, in other words, I think when he included that psychological warfare aspects in his proposals, I don't think he was thinking, well, they're going to use this on civilians, on United States civilians, in Pacific Beach. I think he really was thinking of it as something that would be of use to the United States as a country.
You mentioned that he was using FOIA to try to find out if they had in fact ripped him off, that he was
Yes.
trying to find out through Freedom of Information Act if there are documents that show that they are already using it. But he was getting nowhere with that, right?
He was in the midst of that when we interviewed him. So I mean that's an indication that he was already very suspicious about what was actually going on, that he already suspected that they had stolen it from him. Because a lot of researchers, they come up with a brilliant idea, the first thing they do, they patent it. It turns out that's the worst thing you can do, because the military can take any patent that they want under its national security, and they can steal it, they can rip it off, they can use it, and you're not going to get sent one on that thing.
All right, the Beatles, Nowhere Man, tell us we're going into a break. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions for Robert Guffey about his book Camellio or anything along these lines. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. It's the late Richie Havens with a message that hope springs eternal. Here comes the sun, his 1971 cover of George Harrison's timeless hit. We're talking with Robert Guffey about his new book Camellio. In a moment, we open the phone lines. We get to as many of your questions and comments as we can in our final segment of Coast to Coast AM. Robert, one quick question before we open the phone lines. It's about the goggles. the missing goggles. It occurs to you that maybe they were more than just night vision goggles?
Now, this is entirely speculation
Sure.
on my part and on Damien's part, but we always suspected that perhaps the purpose of the goggles was to be able to see through the invisibility technology. That when you had the goggles on, you could actually see the people who were invisible. Maybe that's just us trying to link up to unrelated events, but it seems rational in the sense of why did they desperately want these things? They could not have been just normal night vision goggles. Why were they so obsessed with them?
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where they probably throw away 100 pairs of those a day, just regular night vision goggles, or burn them in a pile somewhere. And they really wanted these back long enough to go after it for many, many months.
Right, there had years. Yeah,
Years.
there had to be something special about it. Yeah.
All right, let's take a couple of calls. First time caller, Diane in California. Hi, Diane. You're on with Robert Guffey.
Yes, I was just listening to your program, and I had a couple of questions. I went through about 4.5 years of some really crazy stuff in Simi Valley, California. And I was just wondering if you guys had ever heard anything about them doing things to people's eye.
What are you talking about?
Like, I went to an eye doctor once there, and I had the puff of air test, and the one that I took there was extremely painful. And then I kept feeling like there was something in my eye afterwards, and I could see like a shadow in the mirror by my eye, and I kept seeing like the kind of patterns that lasers make with little dots, and they make triangles. I kept seeing that pattern reflecting off of me and on the shower wall and mirrors and stuff sometimes. And I had a lot of things happen to me out there. I was just curious if you guys had ever heard anything about something like that.
I have never heard of anything like that specifically from people who have contacted me. However, I will say that I wouldn't be surprised if people are being gang stalked in Simi Valley. I think that you wouldn't have to do too much to stand out in Simi Valley.
And Diane, when you say crazy stuff was happening to you, meaning what? Was it kind of
Well,
the
I
kinds
mean,
of things?
about 4.5 years, I was being gang stalked, and my phones were tapped, and I kept hearing things on my roof and outside my bedroom window. Every time I would come home, I would hear a certain signal. It was like a whistle. It would go, so I started paying attention and learning their signals, and like they used to use this long pole every time I would be in my bathroom. They forced me out of the house I was living in and into a house they wanted me to live in, which was like a block over from where I lived. And it went from just following me to like total surveillance at that point in my home. And they were using lasers and freaking motion detectors. And just I saw people disappear, literally disappear before my very eyes twice there.
Well, do you, I'd be curious to know, do you have any idea why you think this started, or
Well,
is it just random?
okay, I found out since then that it probably wasn't just one thing, that it was a few things coming together to look like one thing and drive me nuts. But I at one point I think the feds were involved.
But why? Why?
Because I had some relatives that lived in another state that were mules and coming out here to California and buying crystal meth and taking it back there. Yeah, and my dad was like their uncle, and he came to visit me, and I think because of that they thought I was involved because I lived in California, you know.
Diane, thanks for sharing that with us. I want to ask you a question, Robert. Do you think that this is in the hands of regular law enforcement now, beyond intelligence agencies?
I think that there are certain members of law enforcement who are definitely aware of this. I mean, there's always been elements of law enforcement who are also members of intelligence agencies. I recommend Mike Rothmiller's book, The LA Secret Police, which documents all of that very well. And so I wouldn't doubt that at all. San Diego, Simi Valley, both highly conservative areas. And as I mentioned before, with Damien's conversation with the NCIS woman, you know, she basically said to him that they were on a crusade to clean up the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, so they had an agenda that was almost a personal agenda rather than some sort of national security agenda.
Diane, thanks for sharing with us. I was wondering, Robert, have you seen any videos? There's at least one video online that purports to show this invisibility technology. I can't tell if it's real or if it's a trick or some video production kind of a trick.
The only videos I've seen are the invisibility cloaks, like the one I mentioned before with Musashi.
Right.
And so I don't think I've seen those. I would like to see them.
Yeah, I might send it to you then.
Yeah.
We'll have to exchange some emails after the show anyway.
Yeah, sure.
Let's try to go to west of the Rockies, Howard in Vancouver. Hi, Howard.
George and Robert. There is a something in your story here that in Robert's story that stands out that indicates to me that these people were really trying to play the spy game, so to speak. The woman that from NCIS that first contacted Damien, she identified herself as Lydia. Am I correct?
I'm sorry.
Well,
say that again.
Cover. He was wondering about the name, but it's a cover name. It's
yeah. I changed her name.
I see. Well, what I was thinking is that Lydia. That's an unusual name to hear in this country. I do know though that the fiance of Ian Fleming's name was Lydia St. Bartholomew. And she happened to be the assistant to the admiral that was in charge of the British naval intelligence during World War II.
Oh, that's an interesting thought, Howard. But nope, it was Lita was the name, and it was something that that Robert just assigned to it. But thank you for the thought. East of the Rockies, Bill in Westchester, New York. Hi, Bill.
Yes, gentlemen, very interesting show. I would like to ask you a question about the cloaking technology in regard to the plane that disappeared in the Java Sea and the helicopters that were cloaked that were used to get supposedly kill Osama bin Laden, and relate that to the gentleman that did the missing 411, what is his name, Pallades? In our national forest, because after World War II, there was a program by the military to move certain labs, et cetera, into the national forests and to scare people off with a program, I believe it was called Operation Scarecrow. And the idea was to frighten the hell out of people. Sorry if I use that word, if it offends anybody. To keep them out of the national forest because they can cloak things, and that's what I was about to say when I called up when Pallades was on the air, but you guys cut me off before I could finish this particular thought, that why these people are disappearing is this is a military intelligence operation, and they're actually experimenting on the American population as they would be having a tendency to do if they could. And they are, and they may be scapping up people and murdering them in a program for some sort of military operation, biological or chemical, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
To address the first part of your question, in Richard Schoengert's original proposal to the military, he specifically mentioned that you could, in fact, use this to cloak an entire battleship if you wanted to, an entire installation, and so when you ask, could it be used on a helicopter? Absolutely. If you could use it for a battleship, you could use it for a helicopter. As for the missing 411 scenario, could this type of technology tie into that in any way? If it does, it's interesting speculation. That's about all I could say about it. It's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I don't think we can put Robert on the spot for that. That's not his book. But thank you for the call, and it's an interesting idea. We're going to go to the wild card line. Jeff in Culver City. Jeff, good to hear from you.
Yeah, how you doing, George and Mr. Guthrie? Yes, earlier you mentioned that the worst one could do is patent an idea, especially if it's in the interest of the government or military. What would you suggest a person do if he or she has an idea that may be in the interest of these entities, and how could that idea be protected? And also, do you believe that the government has the ability to subject anyone to, or anything, you know, in the process of invisibility, and then project that invisible or cloaked holographic image anywhere on Earth without that person's knowledge? Is that, you know, possible?
Well, the first question, I would say the best way to protect it is to be public about it, because if you patent it, the law states that the military can take whatever they want and use it, and they don't have to ask your permission. So as Bob Lazar figured out, the best thing to do is to be public and in the spotlight. And then the second part of your question was, what was
it? Whether you think the same technology could be used to, like, project a holograph of somebody, you know? I guess that's a little bit beyond your area.
Well, you could absolutely project that there is a specific person. If you want to make it seem as if there is a person standing in your front yard, you could make it to order, sure.
Well, and project it. I don't know. I wonder what the range is for something like that.
I assume that would be possible, simply because if Damien was looking out his window and seeing Boris Vallejo, Three Moon Planets, so if they could project that outside the window, I'm sure they could project a specific person.
Let's go to Matt in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Matt. Good morning.
Morning, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to throw out a little mention of something you were talking about, the invisibility cloak. There's an episode of Future Fantastic, which was done on the Sci-Fi Channel, by Gillian Anderson, in which they did a piece on that. Showed a clip of Predator, talked to some scientist, inventor, whatever he was, and then showed a clip of them doing a test of a mirrored suit that this guy was wearing. So that's out there. That's to add to what you were talking about. That what I wanted to get into was this. Okay. In 1982, my brother and I were in high school, decided to grow marijuana. And unbeknownst to us was the year that Reagan declared his war on drugs. So corn got to be 12 feet tall that year, small patch, 30 by 30. I was living 50, 60 miles outside Washington, D.C., rural farmland type land area. And as the corn got brown, the stuff was still green in the middle. And we started noticing these airplanes buzzing all the time, more frequent and more frequent as the time passed. Anyway, as time progressed, within the next 12 to 18 months, I noticed being followed by what appeared to be private airport aircraft following me. I would leave my house, go to my friend's house, go to another house, and so on and so on. They'd be following me. It's like, I noticed that. It almost seemed like when they noticed I noticed them, they would back off. And I only have a feeling it was because I'm not the only one that was doing it. A lot of other people were doing it that year. And whoever I was rubbing elbows with was rubbing elbows with, and so on and so on. And I think they were, you know, looking into that stuff, obviously. A lot of strange things going on in the sky at night. Lights that just kind of sit there, look like a star, kind of bobble a little bit. And nobody that were my friends believed any of this stuff. They look, it's just a star. And I'm standing there one night with my friend. His back is to the thing, and I'm standing there watching it. Smoked a cigarette outside his parents, because you can't smoke in the house. So I'm watching it. This thing's bobbling and pivoting just ever so slightly, but it bobbled a little more one time. And I said, look at that. And he looks up there and he goes, it's just a star. And that was actually after an incident where a private airplane at night with the lights off came through that area, noticed its point of where it was trying to go. It was a bonfire across the way. You know, things that you find out as time passes. Somebody was renting a farm and doing
Hey, Matt, I'm sorry, man. We're getting a little bit far removed from the topic. I'm going to have to move on. I appreciate you calling in with your story, though. We're going to go to Tom in Taft, California, on the Wild Card Line. Hi, Tom.
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing?
Howdy.
Well, you know, I just want to say I've been involved in this program for about 14 years after falling out with a crime boss that I knew all my life. I can't mention any names, but I didn't know he was a crime boss until after my falling out with him, including my brother, too. And just to hit the nail on the head with a few things, you know, you have General John Jumper, former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force, who said, he goes, I predict we'll have the tools to make people see, hear, and believe things that do not exist. This is the former chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force. This guy didn't escape a mental institution. Lieutenant General Perutz said that I want to put sound in people's heads, and I'm going to hire Laurel Optical in Pasadena to do it. You know, you have Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Thomas, who wrote the military paper, The Mind Has No Firewall, and the military paper, Parameters, Spring 1998, U.S. Army War College, who said that we can use this, we can compromise the microscopic hair cells in the inner ear of somebody. This is a Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Thomas, okay? These are high-ranking military officials. These aren't people that wear tinfoil hats. And this little bit of evidence I've given you thus far confirms that they have the ability to do the very thing that you've discussed tonight on the show.
Tom, you said at the beginning that you've been involved in the program for 14 years. What program are you talking about?
I'm talking about the gang stalking program.
What do you mean you've been involved?
Gaslighting, you know, thing coming in, things moved around in your house, little things missing, vandalism to your floors. You know, you come in, you, giant cuts in your floors, and they want you to call the police so you look like you're a tinfoil hat, so you look like you're crazy. You know, the police aren't going to believe somebody's coming to my house making huge cuts in my floors. Of course, if you came home to your house and you know what your floors look like, and you see a huge cut in them, you're going to believe somebody did it. And, naturally, you know, so, or your chisels cut out of my door frame, or I had a guy approach me and my 8-year-old son at the park February 24th here in Taft telling me, if you open your effing mouth, you're going to go to jail, you know, in front of my 8-year-old son, you know. And I called the police the next day, and I tried to get a police report, you know, and she told me, the sheriff's deputy told me, oh, Tom, you should have called us right when he said this to you and all this, you know. I've had a police car waiting at the bottom of my driveway, a highway patrolman. I took a picture of him on my cell phone. That picture's still on my cell phone.
Let me ask you, Tom, because we're almost out of time, but let me ask you, do you have an idea why?
Yeah. You know,
why you?
I have ringing in my ears. I suffer with tinnitus. I had to go on a
why? Why you?
Disability.
Why?
I had a falling out with this individual I've known all my life, and he told me, Tom, don't be surprised by the time I'm done with you, they don't take you away in a straitjacket. And, you know, he told me this, you know, in Chicago. And, you know, but the thing of it is, and I've had my life threatened more than once. I had a guy come and sit next to me at Starbucks in Ventura, California, one afternoon, and he told me he was an ex-police officer. He was well-dressed in a suit. He was like in his middle 60s, probably. And he goes, can I sit down? Do you have a coffee? He goes, sure.
Tom, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry you called at this time, but we're out of time. But I tell you, I encourage you to send an email to me, and I'll pass it along to Robert, and maybe he can share some information with you. But you should check out the website that he had mentioned earlier. Thanks also to our earlier callers. Let me ask you one final question. Well, it sounds like we're not going to have time. I was curious about whether being a Freemason has caused you any problems in terms of people taking your story credibly, but we'll save that for another time. Robert Guffey, thanks very much. Chameleo is the book, and it's a fascinating read.
Thank you.
I hope you'll keep us informed about your next project. This is an important book, and I hope people will check it out.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks also to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten and Ben Haley, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galani, producer Chris Boros, and I'll be back next Saturday and Sunday night. Hope you can join us then. Good night, everyone.